So tributes have been coming in all day for the veteran BBC broadcaster Sir Terry Wogan, who died after a short illness. His family confirmed that in a statement, Sir Terry died after a short but brave battle with cancer. He passed away surrounded by his family. He was born in Limerick, had a 50-year career on radio and television, including presenting Wake Up to Wogan on BBC Radio 2 and, of course, the Wogan Chat Show on BBC TV. He was also the voice of Eurovision in the UK for many years and had been involved in Children in Need Appeal since it began in 1980. He was part of our lives, wasn't he? Let's start by listening to some of his 50 years at the BBC, or as he called it, Andy.
Terry Wogan.
It's the housewife's choice, Terry Wogan.
Let's hang on
to what we've got. My mother always, because mothers remember things like that, remembers me doing commentaries along with the radio. And I was always obsessed with the radio.
I love radio because I can impose my own pausing on it, I can impose my own timing on it, and because people think while they're listening to the radio.
Dive hand of the curious.
Please don't stop your singing of the floral dance. Never have I laughed as much as I did this morning. Signed, a music lover. See, they're not all locked up yet.
Each one making the most of his chance. Whoops! All together in the floral dance.
I sing like a bird.
This is the Terry Wogan Show on Radio 2.
Linda from Northampton. I am your other listener. Steady, Linda. I fell for your voice many years ago. Drifting into my room, I imagined a tall, manly Adonis. And then I saw you on television. And that's when the headache started. Bob Monkhouse says that I've got it sewn up because my radio program is based on scripts provided by my listeners. And then I take these unpaid scripts which they write for me, put them into a book and sell them back to them.
Who is this tall lump of lard?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Kenny Everett Show.
Terry Wogan.
That's better.
Now, I think you all know why I'm here. I mean, I could have been on Strictly Come Dancing. I could have been on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. But I wanted to put myself through the most degenerating and debasing show of them all. Let's play, never mind the buzzcocks.
Wake up to Wogan on Radio 2.
Mrs. Hershey says we should join them for supper and a few games. They don't bother with television and most evenings have it off.
Here we are with Sir Bruce Forsyth, who makes you seem like a mere stripling. He's in his mid-80s.
But look at him. I mean, dainty on the feet.
Yes.
Fit as a flea.
Indeed.
He'll go on forever.
Yes. So
I won't go on forever. I'll fold my tent and silently steal away one of these days.
Sir Terry Wogan. Now, I've been talking to Gloria Honeyford, Jeremy Vine from BBC Radio 2, and one of Terry Wogan's very good friends, the BBC golf commentator Peter Alice, who told me about hearing the news of Terry's death.
I was having a cup of coffee this morning just after 9 o'clock, and I just heard it on the radio. I found it hard to believe, although I was speaking to Helen, his wife, about 10 days ago, or less than that, was we'd been on holiday a few months ago to their lovely house in France. And how's Terry? Well, I'm afraid he's not very good. The doctors say he's not going to last very long, maybe a month or two. And he lasted just literally a few days. So his last words there, I'll just fold my tent and tiptoe away. Very poignant.
Why was he such a close friend to you? What did you like about him, Peter?
Well, we've known each other for almost 40 years. He's a godfather of our youngest boy, Henry. And we just hit it off the moment we met at the Glen Eagles Hotel up in Scotland for Pro Celebrity Golf round about 1978, I think, 79, something like that. And we were on the right sort of wavelength straight away. And our wives got on very well. And it was just one of those strange associations. We talked about our jobs in a rather irreverent way, I suppose, which amused him and amused me. But he really was pretty well always the same. That's not to say he didn't get cross with other fools and rude people. He couldn't stand rudeness. He could be a bit sharp on occasion, but I don't think many of the public ever saw that. He always said to me, "We must never let them know how easy we think it is to just waffle on about the subject we're involved in." Because, he said, some of them go with copious papers and work into the late, into the night, yeah, writing things down. He never really did any, or, well, he did always did a bit more. He was very well read. He was about, in golfing terms, he was about 12 handicap in about four languages. But he was, he did read a lot of bits and pieces, and he had very, very good knowledge of general knowledge, bits and pieces, odd things, which it's an art given to very few. He was able to, whatever happened, he could speak. A lot of people, they just dry up and they stumble. And whether you like it or not, or whether you like my work or his work, we were liked well enough for people to give us gainful employment. I've been with the BBC since 1961, and I'm still fooling them somehow. God knows how I've done it, but well, maybe because golf's a bit of a fuddy-duddy old game. Well, but he had a warmth and a charm, and he liked the good things in life. He was the first one to say, if you're going to have a cigar, try and have the best one you can.
And he liked the drink, didn't he?
Oh, he enjoyed the drink. He had a very good wine cellar, and his wife was a wonderful cook, and the children were great. His children and our children got on very well together. We've seen them married, and the children arrive, and we used to have Sunday lunches together. You know, about every 8-10 weeks, we'd go over to his house, Taplow, and they'd come down here to our house, and we'd just have a very jolly afternoon and talk and waffle on. And it's a gift, whether it's an Irish gift. Some people would say, yes, it is. Whether it's something the little people or the leprechauns or whatever other little bit of magic you want to put on it, it's a gift that he had. He had a fine voice, a nice voice, an interesting voice.
I'm not sure if it's Irish, Peter. I just think it's called charisma.
Well, whatever it is, but the Irish seem to have it in a lot more often than some people I can think of.
Tell me about this longest ever televised putt which you witnessed.
Well, that was on the last green at the Glen Eagles Hotel on the King's Course. It was actually, we paced it out, I think it was 36 paces. And the great thing is, it's been shown a couple of times today, you see him hit the ball, and then you follow the ball all the way across the green. So there's no cutting in and faking it. So, you know, we'll show that bit and that bit, and then the ball eventually going in the hole. It travelled in, and it was dead in the centre. And the number of people that said to me afterwards, how many goes did you give him at holding that? He could have been there for the rest of his life and never hold it again. It was just one of those things. It was pro-celebrity golf. He was playing with Fuzzy Zeller, the American Open champion, round about that time. And it was just a silly, joyous occasion. And that record stood, the longest putt hold on television, for 15 years, almost 20 years.
Peter, stay there for me, because the broadcaster Jeremy Vine is joining us now as well. Hello, Jeremy.
Hi to you.
Thanks for talking to us, Jeremy. I was flying back from England to Northern Ireland myself. I got off the plane and I tweeted, lots of us will think, whether we knew Terry or not, that we've lost a friend. And I think that was his brilliance, that we kind of feel like we've lost one of our best mates. Many of us never have met him.
Yes, I was just listening to Peter there, so jealous of having the friendship. I wish I'd been a contemporary and had been able to have that. He was my colleague, and he was certainly friendly. He was more than friendly. He always had time. I mean, that's one of the great things I'll remember about Terry, is that, you know, I was a very junior arrival as a presenter. He'd been there, 30 years and more at Radio 2 by the time I came there. But he always had time to talk, and he made you feel a bit special, that you were a bit important and all of that, which he definitely didn't need to do, because he was, you know, at the top of the heap. And I think, you know, for me, I suppose I was fascinated by him as another radio person. And I think now, just today, I think it's possible to say he is probably the greatest music broadcaster since the invention of the microphone in this country. And that's because chiefly of, one, his longevity, which very few others will have, and radio is all about being there every day, day in, day out. and two, his style, which you've alluded to. And I know Peter said he could sometimes be a bit sharp, and I think there was a bit of that on the air. I think he was sometimes quite waspish. He was very bright on the air. I remember talking to my colleague Mark Lawson, who's about the best read person and the smartest person in the BBC, saying, God, Wogan, Mark said Wogan could have done anything. He could have been a poet. He's that bright. And for him as a broadcaster, the key thing was that you felt you were in the room with him and he was in the room with you, and it was just you he was broadcasting to. And maybe it was easy for him, but you know, thousands have tried that and they haven't succeeded.
Did he reinvent himself? I've heard all day that he constantly reinvented himself. Did he? Or was it just his style endured for so long?
It's funny. I mean, I think sometimes the world, you know, changes, and then something that's been quite old becomes quite new.
Exactly. So
exactly. I don't think he did. I mean, he used to make this joke that he's just reading out people's emails, you know. It used to be letters, now it's emails. And it was the same five people, he used to joke. And then it had been in the 70s. And of course, now, you know, then you turn on Breakfast News or some other program and they're all reading out emails. So suddenly he became cutting edge. But I think, you know, it's true that a lot of his material brilliantly was supplied by his listeners. And then as he joked, he then sold it back to them in books. But, you know, he was able to take, and he was actually, in terms technically as a DJ, he was very adroit. He could speak in the gap between two records for 12 seconds and say something that you remembered for 12 years. And that, you know, you didn't feel there was a lot of flannel. And even though you look back and he spent nearly 40 years on Radio 2, you know, you can't remember exactly what he said. Every time you listened, you felt he'd imparted something of value. And, you know, it was a funny thing that happened to me one day, actually, which was that there was a tube strike on and I ran into work. So I had to run about 5-6 miles. And I wasn't very good at running. And I got into Radio 2 and I had my tracksuit, my T-shirt on, and I was just all sweaty. And I went to stand by the lift, and there standing next to me is Sir Terry. And he's completely differently dressed. He's got a cream linen suit on, and he's as cool as a cucumber carrying a briefcase. And you'll know, Stephen, those lifts at Radio 2 are very small.
Yeah.
And we go in. I'm out of breath. I'm all sweaty. Terry is ultra cool. And he hits the button for the sixth floor where his studio is, because at the time he was the breakfast presenter. And I'm about to hit the second floor button, and then I look at my watch and I say, blimey, it's 28 minutes past. You're on in 2 minutes, Terry. I said, I won't hit second. We'll go up to six and get you at your studio. So we hit the six. He goes out, walks off to his studio. I go down to the second, turn on the radio. The news ends. There's the jingle. There's Wogan's voice. And he just says, you know, strange things happen in a tube strike. And this morning, I met my colleague Jeremy Vine in the lift, and he'd been running 6 miles from Hammersmith, and believe me, you could tell. And I thought, that's the genius. He hadn't got his opening link until I gave it to him in the lift.
Yeah. Gloria Honeyford joining us now. Hello, Gloria.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm doing okay, thank you. Sad day, but we're hearing about Sir Terry's life, and you know what it's like, Gloria? You get a sense, and the public will get a sense of the real man that Sir Terry was, of how he treated people behind the scenes as much as what he was like in front of the camera. What was he like with you?
Well, he was brilliant with me, because when I came across to stand in for Jimmy Young for 2 weeks, nobody had a clue who I was anyway over in England. And Terry set about to make sure that they did know. So that famous interchange that they had, which really was legendary, was fantastic for me. But he immediately called me Gus Honeybun and Honey Glory Ford. And because he called me names and things, it sort of got me known at that point. And as you know, in Northern Ireland, we broadcast sometimes in a rather scathing and a mocking way, but we just take that as read. And
yeah,
of course, Terry did the same thing. But the mere fact that out of innocence and naivety that I gave him back as good as he gave me, I believe that that actually got me the permanent job on Radio 2. So really, he was instrumental in turning my life around. And, you know, I didn't have an agent or anything when I went to London. He said, come into my agency. So even though I'd known him in Northern Ireland through interviews and so on, he's been in my life, my adult life, for so long. And I have to tell you, I beyond belief, I was just shocked and really upset. Lost a member of my family, that's how I feel. And I do believe that if you're on the air every day and if people like you and stay with you, that, you know, Terry became family to every single listener.
There was a lovely observation from Father Brand Darcy, who said that if you had an opportunity to look around Sir Terry's home, there are no pictures, Gloria, of stars on the wall. It's his family. It's his friends behind the scenes. And that whole world of showbiz was left behind on the walls of his home.
Well, I was about to say that for me, he was just a fantastic man, but a fantastic husband, and most of all, a great family man. And, you know, I always called him my grandfather. I'd say, oh, have you seen my grandfather, old Wogan, today? And when he became a grandfather in real life, I used to tease him and say, right, what's it like now to be a grandfather? He loved having grandchildren, loved his family. And it always made me laugh out loud when he'd say, ah, now the present Mrs. Wogan, or the present Lady Wogan, as she became. And it just always made me laugh the way he talked about it. But Helen really was the core of the family. And he had not only wonderful love for Helen and the family, but great respect. So I just loved him all round. Loved him as a man, loved him as a broadcaster, loved him as a family person. He was just a great all-rounder. And you're right, you didn't really see him at too many of the showbiz do's. You know, he went to what he wanted to go to. But, you know, I also think, I've been thinking today about, you know, things that he made popular, like Dallas was just an absolute disaster until he started to talk about the poisoned dwarf and Sue Ellen and her drink. And then, of course, Dallas became huge. Same with, he went to see Blood Brothers. And he just, you know, again, Blood Brothers hadn't really been that well received in the West End. But Terry, of course, said, I loved it. You've all got to go and see it. And it's still a popular thing on both sides of the Atlantic today. So he was a great influence.
Yeah, for those people, Jeremy Fine, who say that he made it up as he went along, he walked in the studio and that was it. There was a cleverness in his broadcasting that I reckon had quite a lot of forethought, actually. These characters who he created, you know, that's the sign of someone that understood radio and understood how to create a character and then milk it.
Yeah, and I think he had this odd thing where it was exclusive but inclusive. So there was a bit of a code with Wogan, and these characters came up again and again, and the in-jokes got so complicated and brilliant, which sounds a bit off-putting, but actually once you were in the club, you were there forever. And so I think, yeah, he, you know, all comes down, I think, to this invention. He had this thing he did every year with the silent fireworks where they would pretend there was a firework display and they would go ooh and ah and everything. And it was honestly funnier every single year he did it. I think it's funny, isn't it? Because people will talk about he didn't like to rehearse. He was, you know, my story about him coming up in the lift and then suddenly he starts the show like that and everything suggests that it was all just on the hoof. But actually, I think he had a brilliant mind as a broadcaster. And the chief connection, I actually think, listening to some of the tributes today, the main connection with his listeners was on values. I think this is how great broadcasters work, that he connected because people felt that they really liked the person he was and that he represented what they were or what they wanted to be, or, as Gloria says, what they want their grandfather to be. And, you know, the classic thing is, if I said to you, OK, let's name a TV newsreader, he's coming round to your house tonight, fill in the blank, you wouldn't really know who was coming. If I say Wogan is coming for dinner tonight while he was alive, you'd say, oh, my God, of course, I know exactly who that is. And he managed to give us 360 degrees of his personality through the medium only of his voice. That's the
quite
amazing
interesting
thing.
Jeremy, if I can just chip in on that very point about what he gave the listener, a person actually from Cornwall got in touch with me. He just wanted to say how sorry he was to hear about Wogan. He said, I grew up with him. You know, my dad always had him on the radio. He said, as I got older, I just took him with me and I always listened to him. And he was really, really upset. But he had a very good phrase. He said, to me and to younger people, he was like the father of the nation. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really good line.
I think that is true. And I think he's, you know, I think he may be the greatest broadcaster we've seen. I think he's partly because he was there for so long and partly because of who he was. Absolutely, Gloria.
And also, you know, that word unique is bandied around all the time, but I believe that he was truly unique, and I agree with you. I don't think there'll ever be a broadcaster like him again.
Well, I was just on Twitter a bit, and there was an amazing number of people getting in touch about him, just people because they just want to express it. I think that it's all summed up in the story where, you know, somebody says, how many listeners do you have? And he could have said 9 million because it was breaking records at the time. And he said, only one. And that is why he was so great. He never talked to a crowd. He just talked to you.
I love the story where apparently the Queen asked him how many years had he been working at the BBC, and he said he hadn't worked a day in his life yet.
He said, I've never worked here. Yeah.
It's very funny what Jeremy was saying, though, about the prep, you know, the fact that he gave the impression he didn't do any prep. I have a theory that when he was on that drive-in from Buckinghamshire in the car, he had a briefcase full of stuff that he'd already read. But he used to say to me, if I was in too early, he would say, what on earth are you doing in here, you know, reading research and all that sort of stuff? It's only radio. Just go on and just talk. But I think he did a lot of homework behind the scenes.
I was just going to say that I think as well, one interesting thing is that he didn't overwork and he didn't probably do, he turned a lot of stuff down, I think. Like Gloria says, he didn't do showbiz events. He lived quite a regular life in many ways. He watched a lot of TV. I'm pretty sure he watched all the soaps. And he was, you know, embedded with the life his listeners were living for a lot of it. So he actually had a lot of stuff to say, which is hugely helpful.
He loved the BBC, obviously, Jeremy, and he didn't switch around channels. He did do some stuff for Channel 4 and Channel 5 towards the end of his career. What was his relationship like, do you know, with the bosses, and how did he manage that relationship? There's one thing loving the BBC and another thing managing the bosses, so as a broadcaster you can do what you do.
Well, he came from the generation of broadcasters who believed they were and probably were more important than their bosses. They thought, I think, that, you know, the bosses just did the heating and lighting. And then he gradually was at home in the BBC where the bosses asserted themselves and said, look, we're in charge and we will end your show if we want to. I mean, that's the BBC we're all in now. And I think he made that transition in a very smooth way. And by the end, I think his exit is one of the textbook exits from a radio show, because it's very hard to go out at the top as he did and to not look as if you've been pushed, as he did, and to almost make it your own timing and to choose the moment. And one thing that happened that I think was very sad in all this was that he had a producer called Paul Walters for many years, who Gloria will know, who he was devoted to and who was devoted to him, who very sadly died about 5 years before, or maybe 3 or 4 years before Terry left the show. And I think ideally for Terry, they would both have ended the time at breakfast together. But I think he, you know, the way that he ended it, to me, the way he stopped his breakfast show, to me showed that he remained in charge of his broadcasting career and his destiny till the end. And I think that that's a very powerful thing, because too often it ends badly, you know. So, and it didn't for him. It really didn't.
Let me ask all three of you. Peter Ellis, we'll start with you. What your abiding memory of Sir Terry Wogan will be?
Just his ability to say words when words were needed. I don't think he would like anyone to analyse him. Everyone, well, certainly over the next few days, people will analyse Terry Wogan. What was the magical thing? What was this? What was that? How did he do it? I think it just happened with him. And I've been privileged to be with him when he's been going to work, when we've been on television programmes together. And he always took a little book with him. He'd sit in the dressing room and he'd read a novel or he'd read something of interest. His life and work really doesn't need analysing to the nth degree. He was what he was, which is a total broadcasting genius, a lovely man, enjoyed life, enjoyed his family, had a lovely wife. He was just a very fortunate man, and he knew it all the way through. He said that all the time, whether he's making jokes about this really isn't work. He loved it. It was at times hard work. I think that was probably because he had bad old knees that were knocked about when he used to play rugby. But he just enjoyed life, and he was always mindful of the fact that, in his opinion, it was all very easy, and money came. He didn't have a money tree. He said, I have a small money orchard down the back of the garden. And I thought, that'll do for me. And he was a dear, dear, dear family friend, and I shall miss him.
Peter, thank you. Gloria? Lovely.
Yes, I remember him most of all as a friend and a great storyteller, and also someone who never forgot his Irish roots. He was never afraid to come out with the Irish phrases, whether English people understood it or not. He was still saying, I was washing under me oxters and all that sort of stuff. He just stuck to his roots and loved the stories and told a story better than anybody I can think of. And I just am very proud to have known him and his family, and I've thought all day about Helen and the boys and the grandchildren.
Gloria, thank you. Jeremy?
Oh, two very quick things. When I was 6, in the kitchen, in Cheam in Surrey, the radio on, a new radio, and Wogan introducing Dancing Queen by ABBA. And then when I was 37,
in Radio 2, meeting him and thinking, my goodness, I've actually arrived on Wogan Station.
Jeremy, thank you very much indeed. Lovely to talk to you. Gloria, thank you for spending time with us. Peter Ellis, thank you. And let's get your calls now. 0330 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning. The text table 7771 at Stephen Nolan on Twitter today. It's 9:30. We'll get the news from Keith and then we'll come back to you. Stay with us. Pat, morning, Pat.
Morning, Stephen.
Go ahead, Pat.
Just bringing in, I'll keep it short and sweet, Stephen. Sorry for our loss, because although I wasn't a particular fan of Terry Wogan, I was a very... I did recognise and do recognise what Wogan did and managed to do, you know, with his broadcast. He's really been, he left his epitaph and he said, my friend, he spoke directly to people. And he made you feel as if he was talking directly to you, you know, sort of not at you or not to somebody else,
yeah.
Sort of not to a crowd. He said, it was a one-to-one thing he managed to do. And the other key to it, and I think really the reason he was so effective, he was a man who's happy with himself, happy with his own skin, happy to be talking to you. You know, he was enjoying himself. You know, that's what came across. He was enjoying himself. You know, sort of sometimes I thought it was a bit too much, you know, sort of, because he was one of them men, what he called, you know, sort of, he loved the sound of his own voice. But it's not, he was worth listening to, you know, sort of, if you like that sort of thing. And he spread a bit of happiness, and he spread it on a one-to-one basis.
Pat, thank you very much indeed. Sean Rafferty, morning, Sean.
Good morning to you.
Good morning. Sad, sad news that we all woke up to yesterday.
I mean, it's all the cliches come springing to mind. Legend, extraordinary figure. Maybe it's only when somebody goes that you realise the worth they've had. I mean, look at the longevity of Terry Wogan. He never sounded jaded. He never sounded tired. He was always interested in what he was doing. He adored talking to people. You could hear the warmth. You could hear the humour in his voice. But beneath all that, he was a very, very shrewd broadcaster, a fine mind. And, I mean, there isn't anybody like him, really.
Yeah, because for the... lasted as long as he has, Sean. It couldn't be that he just bumbled in and bumbled out again, as some people are suggesting. There must have been a lot of shrewd activity in there.
Oh yeah, it was all underneath, like the sort of the iceberg, really, seven eighths going on, but the effortless surface. Mind you, it is of an Irish trait, I think, to fly by the seat of your pants. And when I heard Jeremy Vine saying, you know, 9:28, 2 minutes to go to be on the air, I mean, we're a little bit more sedate than Radio 3 where I am, but when I went, I'm telling up 5 minutes beforehand, they're all saying, where the hell is he? I said, it's fine, I'm here. The microphone's not open yet, it'll be all right. So I think there's something in the Irish character that can deal with the sort of formality imposed by broadcasting and just gave it a more elasticity. And he did that. He sort of bent it, really, to the way he wanted. I mean, as your last caller said, really, really enjoyed himself. And my goodness, if you don't enjoy yourself and take pleasure in what you're doing and all the different things and the music, I mean, classical side from me, you're not going to communicate it to the audience and you're not going to last.
And you've done both, Sean, both television and radio. Radio was Terry's first love.
Absolutely, I would agree with him. It was my first love as well. I mean, television is, obviously it's a great medium, it can do wonderful things, but I think on radio you maybe listen more to what people are saying, your imagination takes flight more, and you have a better sort of mental engagement with what's going on. Sometimes I think we see pictures and they just wash over us and we don't necessarily take in the content as much. And I think radio is, in many ways, it's much more demanding, as you know, and it's certainly more immediate. And I think it's more familial to people. I think it's the senior service, after all.
Always nice to talk to you, Sean. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, it's lovely to talk to you. We're all very, very sad about it. I think they broke the mould, really, when they made Terry. And what a typically dignified and private way to go out. You know, no sound of trumpets, no showmanship. He was a very private man in his own way, and as Gloria and everyone has been saying, adored his family. I mean, he you know, how many if you like celebrities, I hate that word, which I suppose was foisted on him too, how many people retained their dignity, their ordinary life, and still managed to make it?
Thank you, Sean. Morning to you. 9:35, Father Brian Darcy was a close friend of Sir Terry. Good morning to you, Brian.
Good morning, Stephen.
Thank you for talking to us.
No, you're welcome. Glad to be able to do it.
What type of man was he?
he's all the things that everybody has said, all of them and a little more. He was a terrific friend, very loyal, never forgot where he came from. In fact, you know, the first thing that I would do when I would go over to him would be I'd bring a few Irish papers over.